Yes, today I'm going to talk about in the third section on carnal pleasure, spirituality and sensuality. One of the board members said to me, I think that's an oxymoron, which means an essential contradiction. And, you know, that's not as uncommon as might be seen. I don't think it would be a common way of looking at these words in this group, but that you must keep the erotic and the spiritual miles apart is not too long a memory ago for many of us in our growing up. There's a thought for the day that I get every day. By the way, can I be heard well in the back? Okay, good. And this one is from the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., most progressive, wonderful, alive group. And I love the authors they pick from to say things. But I was amazed at the synchronicity for me today in the selection for today. It was taken from Elaine Pagels, who has written a lot in terms of early scriptures and other things. And in a book called Beyond Belief, this is the section for today. When I found that I no longer believed everything I thought Christians were supposed to believe, I asked myself, why not just leave Christianity and religion behind, as so many others have done? Yet I encountered in churches and elsewhere something compelling, powerful, even terrifying, that I could not ignore, and have come to see that besides belief, Christianity involves practice and paths toward transformation. I would say that very much for myself, that passage. Within Catholicism, within Christianity, but particularly within the Ursulines, I became an activist. I marched. We had to retroactively get our habits out of the trunk. I marched in Washington, D.C. I went to St. John of the Divine, the time that Martin Luther King was speaking, and it was filled with nuns and priests and that who hadn't kept up with Martin Luther King and thought we were coming to talk about integration, something they espouse. But when they found out that Martin Luther King was against the war in Vietnam, people got up in the middle of his lecture, that famous lecture, and walked out. However, I was among a group which for some time had already been speaking in the classroom, talking to people about the problems of being in this particular war in Vietnam. Along the lines of which I knew personally, and that is the fruits of colonization. Because I grew up in a colony, and St. Kitts, the British West Indies at that time. I'm very grateful for being brought up in a colony, because I knew there was a world besides my house and our town. I knew from stamps of the British colony encompassing the whole world. And they came to our island, people from Fiji or India or China. My first boyfriend at 11 was Chinese. You know, I lived in a multiple world. And when you do that, it's very hard to be sort of chauvinistic about your own country. You feel the whole planet. Today, we're going to talk about, within the context of this book, which is basically the idea of a religion of one's own, but speaking more directly to the people who have been reared or believers in the monotheistic religions. Some of us have also, since our childhood, experienced some of the freedom of non-monotheistic religions, for example, Hinduism and Buddhism. But there are lots of other non-monotheistic religions like Native American, and going back to matrilinear, I think we could say now, without the kind of aspersions we cast on it, paganism and matrilineal focal religions. But I'm speaking today mostly to some of the tendencies in monotheism to be very negative about sexuality. Arguably, Christianity, of the three monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, I'm saying them in their historical orientation, arguably Christianity has been the most suspicious of pleasure, desire, and the deeply erotic. Mostly suspicious that it was very, very dangerous. We might say today we see some of that in the Muslim religion. I don't know a lot about Islam, so I'm not going to speak other than to talk about their tradition. And so what I'd like to do is to begin by reading a few fragments from Rumi. I have, for anybody who wants to look over it, an entire volume on Rumi translated by Colin Barks. Now let's see if I'm going to be able to find this. It would be wonderful to have, you know, somebody who would know exactly what I wanted, like on TV, you know, how they have somebody who... Okay, yeah. My beloved is one poem. Know that my beloved is hidden from everyone. Know that she is beyond the belief of all belief. Know that in my heart she is as clear as the moon. Know that she is the life in my body and in my soul. That was presented in a volume by Deepak Chopra. And in the same volume, this second one, there is a place where words are born of silence, a place where the whisper of the heart arises. There is a place where voices sing your beauty, a place where every breath carves your image in my soul. It's a song from one lover to another. Yet we find in the Bible, made up of the Torah and the New Testament, a book so deliciously honoring of pleasure, desire, and the erotic. It is the Song of Songs, the Canticle of Canticles, or the Song of Solomon. We know he did not write it, but I guess his largeness of spirit, it seemed good to ascribe it to him along the way. In tradition so adamant that all sexual pleasure must take place only in marriage, we have the poetry of two lovers in the first blossoms of discovery, now united, now separated, now sought, now found. These words come from the introduction to this book in the Jerusalem Bible. The Jerusalem Bible appeared in 1966, and it was an attempt to make use of the scholarship of many religions that took place in Jerusalem. And this particular translation was a translation, of course, into English. The book itself first appeared in France, maybe just a year or two before 66. So what do we have in this book of the Song of Songs? Oh, it's only 8 chapters, but I'm not going to read them all. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. This is what the woman says. Your love is more delightful than wine. Delicate is the fragrance of your perfume. Your name is oil poured out. And then she goes on, he goes on. I'm skipping a good bit. I'm now at chapter 4. This is the groom. This is the male. You can't really call them bride and groom, as this translation does, because it's presented as though they have relatively recently met, this couple. You ravish my heart, my promised bride. You ravish my heart with a single one of your glances, with one great pearl of your necklace. Isn't that lovely? And placed further, he says, she is a garden enclosed, my promised bride, a garden enclosed, a sealed fountain. We know what that means. Then he says, I come into my garden, my promised bride. I gather my myrrh and balsam. I eat my honey and my honeycomb. I drink my wine and my milk. Eat, friends, and drink. Drink deep, my dearest friends. The bride says, I sleep, but my heart is awake. I hear my beloved knocking. Open to me, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew and my locks with the drops of night. I have taken off my tunic. Am I to put it on again? I have washed my feet. Am I to dirty them? My beloved thrust his hand through the hole in the door. I trembled to the core of my being. Then I rose to open to my beloved. I opened to my beloved, but he had turned his back and gone. Oh, dear. My soul failed at his flight. I sought him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but did not answer. Remember hide and seek? And then the chorus says, I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, if you should find my beloved, what shall you tell him? That I am sick with love. What makes your beloved better than other lovers, O loveliest of women? What makes your beloved better than other lovers to give us a charge like this? She goes, my beloved is fresh and ruddy, to be known among 10,000. His head is golden, pure as gold. His locks are palm fronds and black as a raven. How many of you have read this book? Few? Oh, great. Good for you. Good for you. Where did your beloved go, O loveliest of women? Which way did your beloved turn so that we can help you look for him? And she says, my beloved went down to his garden, to the bed of spices, to pasture his flock in the gardens and gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flocks among the lilies. And then the very last conclusion. Who is this coming up from the desert, leaning on her beloved? I awakened you under the apple tree, there where your mother conceived you, there where she was to give birth to you. Let me... This is very quoted. Set me like a seal on your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is strong as death, jealousy restless as Sheol. The flash of it is a flash of fire, a flame of Yahweh himself. Love, no flood can quench. No torrents drown. Now, this is the heritage of all three monotheistic religions. This is our heritage if you came from, if your childhood was influenced by them. It's It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's erotic. But this writing was considered so dangerous in the convent, my very progressive convent, that the text couldn't be read in the refectory, in the dining room. You know, when we heard a small pericope of the Bible before the chosen book. Because we ate in silence in 1954. Yet, many of these texts were used in the liturgy of the blessing of virgins at the time novices made their vows. Some of these passages are extremely familiar to me after being, you know, twice a year at a profession at whatever stage you were in your dedication. In Judaism, this book was included in the canon in the 2nd century. In Christianity in the 4th century, only after it was made clear that it was to be understood metaphorically as a metaphorical tale of God and his people, or Christ and the church. I don't know if you know that in the Catholic Church, I don't know what the situation is now, a Bible that was Catholic could not be published without footnotes because you needed help with some passages. This would be one of the passages you needed help. Now, if something is used as a positive metaphorical story, I think it's not far-fetched to say that it's assumed that the underlying image is also positive. You know, just think of this. It is so outrageous to say this is there because it has to do with a tale, the best way to talk about God's love for us. And at that time, a kind of equality between God and God's people. But beware the underlying image. Do you hear the irony? Historically, Judaism and Christianity were ambivalent about including this tale of this mutual erotic pursuit among the sacred text. The erotic play of hide and seek, of dismay and joy, this very natural attraction that ensures the continuation of the human race on earth, was to be played down. The underlying image, you know. Because a metaphorical interpretation works as a story of Yahweh and his people, it also inspires the beauty, goodness, and sacredness of the underlying love story. That's my edit. I'm going to come back to this notion at the end of the day. That is the notion that a metaphorical use assumes the same value for the image that gave rise to it. So how could we have come so far that the celebration of human love and sexuality is suspect? Now, all of the seven, and of course there are lots more, but all of the seven virtues, including chastity, have their deadly counterparts. For instance, something like envy and hate and violence, all you could say are counterparts to love your neighbor, love your God. But there's no other virtue that has elicited such an all-or-nothing response. Admittedly, the sexual desire releases some powerful hormones. In fact, other sins also do. Anger releases testosterone in men and women. You know, women have testosterone as well as men. Aggression, And it decreases cortisol, which is a sort of soothing hormone. So it can't be argued that at some intuitive level they knew that the trouble with love and pleasure and desire is that it releases insurmountable hormones that we can't subject to choice from a perspective of our values. That it does, and we even have songs that in some way capture that power. Do you all remember, all of us of my generation would? I get no kick from champagne. You know, mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. But I get a kick out of you. So innocent, right? It is of the interest of societies, including the churches, to protect the young as they transition from child to adult, to protect marriage and the raising of the next generation, to protect the fabric of society from being endangered, from many things, as well as eros gone amok. But let's just note that in the text we're talking relative to, the Talmud, the Torah, and the Bible, that the first sin was a sin of eating an apple they were told not to eat. It was a disobedience, a kind of sin of pride, you know, and maybe the second sin that was named was murder, Cain and Abel. So we have a lot of things that we need guidance on. But I don't think anything that requires an all or nothing. Now, those of you who come out of Protestant tradition, I don't think you had it quite so bad as we did. But I remember at 14, a product of the convent boarding school and the vibrant energy of the West Indies, you should have seen it at carnival time, that I challenged the common Catholic teaching that all sins against purity were serious sins, mortal sins, because that's what we were taught. There's no poverty of matter when it comes to chastity. It's all or nothing. I can remember where I was, close to the house of a boy I had a crush on, where I was when I concluded that this teaching was wrong, impossible. So if I wore short shorts, I wasn't an occasion of sin to all young males. And I got validated by my good Irish mother, who had the good fortune of being educated in boarding school by the Ursulines in Sligo. I knew I wasn't living in sin, nor was it even a problem. Here again, I think society and religion tends to hold women responsible for men's behavior. I was really puzzled why monotheism had this kind of view. And those of you who come out of or have studied a Jewish tradition, when we get to interaction time, you might say something. In general, I think Jewish people of the Reformed Church do not have this kind of, but you know, in Jerusalem right now, women are just now trying to get their place at the Wailing Wall. This was in the news a couple of days ago. Okay, well, it actually, one of the guys we could blame was Aristotle in Greece. Aristotle, you know, most of his ramblings were written down by Plato, because he didn't actually do that. Did I have that wrong? Excuse me. Plato wrote down Socrates. Oh. But patriarchy was already in place at the time of Aristotle. Women, he imagined as having a place between men and slaves. they were a little higher than slaves, but they were not equal to men. And so in Plato, he questioned whether or not women really had souls, which was for Plato something big. We know it's been in this culture starting around 500 years B.C. If we go back, and I'm not very trained in the matrilineal, I've done some work on Maria Gimbutas's work, where she excavated and interpreted writings from that time and earlier in Turkey or up in further north. I can't remember the name now. But there's a lot of research done. There was none of that in matrilineal times. So today, we know, I think, that Eros does not limit itself to... Oh, I know what I'm... I have to transition to another thought here. I don't know if those of you who are... Next year, I'm going to be 80. And being the youngest in my family, I'm always proud when I'm a little bit older than the year before, because it was definitely a disadvantage to be the youngest in the family. Today we know that Eros does not limit himself to affecting love only to attain members of the opposite sex. Eros and who he moves to love is very mysterious. As Eros also is not bound by our monotheistic constructs of gender, we are beginning to openly honor the mysteries that have always been there. The mystery of same love, same-sex love. Eros works where it will, and so to my LGBT friends, I grieve that you have had to be so circumspect in your loving. And I celebrate with you the changes in the culture. I do remember, again as a child in the West Indies, knowing of the situation of gay love because things like that weren't covered over. And when someone found out that I was aware of this particular guy, it was like, who taught you those dirty things? You know, so it was there side by side. The condemnation and the naturalness of that. An exercise. You ready for an exercise? Pick your person next to you. What was your early teaching about sexuality by, say, 16? 16, okay, I'm not going back. What did you think about sexual feelings, pleasure in general? Desire for sexual pleasure in particular. And then a second question, I'll give these to you after you pair off. Note if and when you made a decision out of your own experience that something of a sexual nature did not get in the way of your integrity. Like I did at one level at 14. It was only one level. I mean, it allowed me to wear short shorts. Let me just say about the Ursulines, they were definitely more allowing. We never had to put a telephone book between us and a guy if we were seated in a car, which I understand some nuns. And actually, also, while I was in the convent, some other young women in the West Indies who had gone to a convent school said they could not bathe naked. They had to have a chemise on when they bathed. Well, I escaped that. But those who were trained that way, boy, I tell you, it gets in the nooks and crannies of your flesh as well as your mind. And so I want you to sort of be gentle with yourself because it's quite possible there are people in the group right now that still have found it hard to break free to your own experience of whether something is okay or not. your own experience taken in the context of your higher self. You know, not the part of you that wants to get away with some kind of cheap squeeze. At our age, our squeezes aren't that cheap anymore. So this will be short. And if you don't want to speak, don't. Ask that of the people. I'd rather not talk about this. And we'll not go on and on. But I know what. Find your partnering, because some of you end up in a group of three, but a group of two. And this is just sort of like a moment to bring your body in here. Okay, I want to give the questions again. Thank you. What were your earliest teachings about sexuality? What did you think about sexual feelings, pleasures in general, desire for sexual pleasure in particular? Especially around 16, you know. What would you say was your current thinking? And then I'll give the second one also. Note if and when you made a decision to go out of the experience of your group and trust your own experience or the teaching of the group you were in. And what was your own experience? Okay. Yeah. Well, there's nothing inhibited about this group. In the second half, there'll be time for us to talk about some of this in the group as a whole. But I see I'm only halfway through my notes, so I'm going to move on if I can. Okay. In the first, I was basically talking about pleasure. Now I want to talk about desire. Desire is etymologically taken from of the stars, sidera. Is the stars. And if you've been watching it all, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he is just ecstatic as he talks about that we are literally made up of the dust of the stars. I also got another one today from Huntington Press that was beautiful. It said, yesterday we talked about you are dust and unto dust you return. He says, yes, let's celebrate it. We are stardust. So we are stardust and we desire. And desire desires in us with or without our permission. Freud found that his patients were too responsible for their desires. He had a patient in which one of the symptoms in the patient was that he kept on ironing his money notes. And so he was intrigued with this compulsion, you know, to do that. And it came out he was paying for prostitutes. So he had to have clean money. So we try to manage, you know, things, and some part goes underground and some part comes up in ways that can be disconcerting. However, if we sort of almost see desire in us as an archetype, as an element that has a life of its own, then we can choose to entertain it when and where we will. We can decide at some time not to have desire in the forefront. I imagine that would help in a way if you're in surgery. You're the surgeon. Other than the desire for the outcome of this surgery. So Mark Epstein talks very much about how we can find a relationship to desire in which the ultimate would be to honor it. So we don't want to get so close that we distort it. And we don't want to get so far away that we're very safe. And I think the churches have really, for the most part, encouraged us to get far away from it. So that, remember, if you read the book today, he opened with the tale of these two monks, one who carries a woman across a brook and afterwards has no thought afterwards. He put her down, and that was the moral of the story, was that he could. And Thomas More said, no, I like the other guy, the second guy, who's wrestling with that feeling of carrying a woman across a river, because it is more real and it is less guarded and less directed, you know, by the mind, by a pre-decided notion that to touch a woman is dangerous. Epstein says, while some might think the opposite, it is desire that leads to the end of clinging. That is, if you can honor desire, you will find yourself whole, not clinging to the opinions of others, clinging to things that have been predetermined. So it helps to personify desire, animate it, ask what it's wanting. We might well be energized by desire and for the sake of other commitments choose not to pursue externally the fulfillment, but yet allow the desire to run its course in the imagination. This is what we call daydreaming, you know, and if we allow a daydream to run its course, even allow the feelings that are evoked to have their time in the sun, then we are more in this place of beholding desire. We're curious about it. We can allow it rather than stomping over it. In the myth of Psyche, this is called gathering wool. In the story of Psyche, she had four tasks. And one she had to gather the wool of these sacred rams that were ferocious. Okay, you know what's also ferocious. And she was told, why don't you wait until the sun's down and the rams are a little bit content? You know, they're not quite as starved. And you go and you find all of the golden fleece on the trees that they have, like, rubbed up themselves against. It's a lovely image. You could pursue it sometime, gathering wool. And we use that that expression, don't we, for daydreaming, gathering wool. So it's like here I'm suggesting gathering wool might be an incredibly productive exercise for you to find out what other parts of you want or think. We don't come to this position of the right place with desire right away. It's an exploration. And I think this is true both sexually and spiritually. The right way to be with, say, a daydream. And now what I want before the break, I think I've gotten Tom's blessing on going over just a little, is I want to talk about being desired. Being desired. Can we let ourselves be desired? Can we recognize it when we are desired? In the myth of Psyche and Eros, once she had tasted Eros, even though he made her blind herself so she could not see his face, she wanted to be desired more and more. I think we are sometimes afraid to admit to this because it brings new vulnerabilities. Jungians talk of this state of wanting to be desired in archetypal terms as wanting to be desired by the inner bridegroom, the animus, or the inner bride, the anima. Here we are talking simultaneously of being at two levels, the outer and the inner. And here's a vignette. A woman of maybe around 70 told me of a time during a retreat, during an exercise that had been designed to facilitate new experiences. It was a breathing exercise. That she heard a voice, and in her case it was a male voice that spoke with great tenderness. "There you are. Where have you been?" the voice said. "I have searched for you for so many years." Yeah. "There you are. Where have you been? I have searched for you for so many years." Ruth was different after she heard the voice. It seemed she had to stop searching and let herself receive what was already happening. She had a secret lover. This vignette illustrates that desire is not only ours, but we are talking of archetypal love somehow, somewhere, that is located in us. So if we have strong desires, we might ask, what does this desire want of me? I think this is not unlike the thinking behind vocation. Literally, vocation is being called. By whom? Whom is desiring me to be a teacher? Now, who is desiring me to take this step, to host my illness, to recognize I have energy to go forth? I think the story illustrates that seeking, desiring might need to be paired with stopping long enough to experience being desired, being loved, whether by an inner or outer lover. Allowing desire, of course, is very risky, for sometimes we will be disappointed. We see those who have given up, who are shut down, who have cut off desire. They've cut off desire even from love or art or music, so that they won't be disappointed. I talked to Tom before this, in which I asked Tom if he was going to give us a picture of O'Keefe, George O'Keefe's many, many calla lilies. And he told me that even though, you know, that was part of his topic, somebody else is going to do it later, he's going to stress music. Next week, the chapters on art and music. But myself, I think the most sensual flower there is the calla lily. And can you imagine my joy when 3 days ago I spied a tightly bound new, the first one within the place I'm on in my property, and I have watched it. It wasn't in my backyard, and so I went out. I went out after, you know, the rams had gone, and I gathered this flower for us here today. It is so amazing. It is so amazing in its bringing together of symbols of opposite genders. Opposite sex, and it brings them together in such a pure form that I think it is a flower we could just sort of meditate on to help us if we have any, you know, rifts or pain. Even the pain that the idea that sex is beautiful, that the erotic is enhancing, and we're now 80. You know, there are other ways. I'm going to keep this now until all I have left is the deeply erotic, and go enjoy the lunch.